So you're approaching people and just saying, tell me about a movie that was really meaningful to you or taught you something. Do you see people just light up?
Yeah, some people get really excited. And in fact, coming up, we have an episode with a woman who does weightlifting videos on YouTube. And when I approached her about talking about her favorite movie, she was like, nobody ever asked me this kind of stuff. She was quite excited. So I hope you guys stick around for Kaylee Cohen talking about The Outsiders. But the episode we have for you today, actually, is a kind of bonus that we do on VoiceOver where we talk to people about the representations in TV and film of religious communities and people of faith. So you can look in our catalog. We have one about Under the Banner of Heaven. We have one about the Book of Clarence. We have one about Conclave, talking about all these different religious groups. And this one is about actually a small group of nuns in Louisville, Kentucky, the Ursuline Nuns. And it's brought to us by the documentarian Morgan Atkinson. And he actually talks to me about how when he first started making this movie, he had a very definite idea of how he wanted to portray the nuns. And then as he got to know them, he revised his attitude and he revised what he was going to do. Welcome to VoiceOver, Movies That Move Us. I'm your host, Heather Bigley, and I talk to people about movies that made a mark, that led to cinematic epiphanies. And it's not always the movie you'd expect. Today, we're running a bonus episode, another chance to talk about how people of faith are represented in film and TV. And I get to chat with the documentarian, producer, director, and writer, Morgan Atkinson, about how he has worked with and portrayed the Ursuline Nuns of Louisville, Kentucky. The movie we'll be discussing is In the Company of Change, a recent release from Morgan, which focuses on Sister Martha Boozer, a woman who joined the Ursuline Nuns in 1949. Over her lifetime, a number of social and religious changes occurred, which her experiences throw light on. This includes major changes to monastic life as prescribed in Vatican II, which happened between 1962 and 1965, for those of us who aren't Catholic and might not have that imprinted on our brains. And of course, increasing rights and opportunities for women generally that Americans made a priority in the second half of the 20th century influenced who and why women turned to the monastic life. So you're going to hear this kind of remarkable statistic. When Sister Martha joined the nuns in 1949, there were 600 nuns in the convent. And when she died in 2023, there were less than 40 sisters living in the convent, and the median age was 85 years old. While Morgan isn't Catholic himself, his work is focused on remarkable people who live on the margins of society in an inspiring way, including Anna and Harlan Hubbard, social justice pioneer John Howard Griffin, rock musician Tim Krakel, wisdom purveyor Matthew Kelty, the monks of Gethsemane, and of course, Thomas Merton, the internationally recognized Kentucky monk, celebrated for his writings on contemplative spirituality. Just looking through your filmography, this is not the first time that you've approached religious content. You have at least three films about Merton. You have a film about Gethsemane there in Kentucky. So what draws you? You're not a monastic, maybe? I don't think so.
No.
So what draws you? What makes you curious about the monastic life? You've devoted a lot of time, and a lot of your projects are about monastics.
Well, there's good reasons, and I hope they're good, and some that are, frankly, commercial. I mean, Merton, it's, you know, it's a niche, but it's a very international niche of admirers. And so I knew by doing a film on Merton, or several, that people would want to see it. And it's worked out that way, and it's been very gratifying. But initially, going back to the 70s and my mid-20s, I was really, as a lot of people are at that age, sort of in a muddle, very kind way of putting it. And reading Merton really gave me focus, and I tremendously admired his commitment. And prior to that, would not have thought of a spiritual commitment. What's that about? But then I thought, well, I at least want to go see where this person lived. And I went to Gethsemane and was really struck by it and very moved by it. The monastic life is for very few people, but for those who were living it well, I had nothing but great admiration. Would go there on retreats or for weekends and really appreciated my time there. And, you know, after a few years, would ask the abbot there, who's the leader of the monastery, could I do a documentary? And they were like, no, thanks. And then finally, they changed abbots, and the new person said, okay. And so that opened the gates for me, which was very interesting because I'd always idealized these people, you know, put them up on pedestals, and some belong there, but then some are extremely human, and you see warts and all, which is a good way to grow. You can't just, it can't all be ivory tower. You have to, confront the realities of life. So it's good to break down stereotypes and so to see some realities. And I've just always been attracted to people who make that really fierce commitment.
Sister Martha, she's the main voice of your mm-hmm. documentary In the Company of Change, and you'd already made a film about her. That's from 1987, if I remember correctly. And then you decide to go back and do this one. Talk to me about the relationship between the two films. Why go back? Why do more?
Well, it was really one of my first documentaries and the first one that was accepted by our PBS network here in Kentucky to air. You know, I had the good intent of wanting to show this story about this group of women who had done so much for the community of Louisville and other communities. Also, growing up, I grew up a Protestant, and most of my neighbor friends, in which there were a lot in my neighborhood, they went to Catholic schools and were taught by the Ursulines, and they said, these are the meanest women on earth. And I thought, well, that's interesting. And then later in life, when I talked to the sisters, they say, how would you deal with a classroom of 50 kids? They'd be like 23 years old and be dropped into these classrooms where they had to deal with, you know, kids being kids.
We have been dinged into our heads. Anything you're told to do, you can do. Oh, that's not true.
So I saw both stories. But initially I thought, well, I'll show how, you know, tough and mean these women are. And at that time, and continuing to this day, often nuns are portrayed in films as, you know, monsters. The best they get would be as comedic types like Whoopi Goldberg or someone like that.
I got the flow. You all gotta go. So go get your bags so we can go. Ho, ho.
And so in doing that first documentary, I came to a point where, like, you know, I could sort of take some sort of snarky, cheap shots here and probably enhance my viewership. Another take on the mean sisters. And you know, it just didn't feel right. Didn't seem consistent with the people that I met. I did the first program, which was well received on PBS, but also amongst the sisters. They felt like I had done a fair job. In knowing Sister Martha for almost 40 years, I saw her take on the spiritual life evolve and change. Eventually, I asked her to become my spiritual director, and in doing that, you know, she helped me with my own spiritual questions, but she also revealed very human aspects of her own life, which, again, just seeing the full humanity really helps. And so I wanted to do a program that was in part a tribute to her, but also that showed this way of life, not just for the group I featured, but so many across America and across Europe, you know, are just going away. And they trusted me to tell their story in a way that was sympathetic, but not just a complete whitewash.
I'm really touched by what you just said about how you sort of thought, oh, I'm going to go do an expose on these nuns. And then you meet them and you yourself are changed and the content of your film is changed. And that actually takes a lot of humility, I think. And I don't think of film directors as humble people.
Right.
Just to throw that there.
That's why I didn't work in Hollywood, bro. I couldn't pull it off.
So that's, I mean, that says a lot about you, that you were willing to say, I had an idea of where this material was going to take me, but now I see this other thing, and that's what I want to chase, and that's what I want to show. Is that the nature of being a documentary filmmaker, is to midstream say, well, I might have to do something different here?
Yeah. If you stay present in the project and allow it to evolve, you know, it grows and it changes, and you try not to let yourself be suckered in, compromised, but at the same time, you're seeing things in a broader, hopefully deeper way. The monks at Gethsemane, where Merton lived, you know, I've seen news crews go there for an afternoon and they shoot the predictable shots and they put together a nice 2-minute package, which runs on the news. And you go, oh, there's the monks and blah, blah, blah. But then if you've got an hour or more to fill and you spend 2 years there and you're learning individuals and you learn to look for things that are happening that really tell the life more than just, oh, there's a monk chanting. You see a monk dealing with frustration or fear, just being human beings.
We grieve the loss. We celebrate the memories. We give thanks for the blessings.
That's when richness comes out. And I think you see that in any project. And so, yeah, you go along and you think, well, these two people are the main characters. And then you realize, whoa, wait a minute. This person is really telling a story that I think is faithful to the underlying theme, but telling it in a much better way. And so that changes too.
Sister Martha, she seems to be an important person in your life, an important person in the first documentary, now the second documentary. What was your process? Did you say to her, I'm going to put this together? Or had she already passed at that point? Or
she knew and was very open to it. I think in a way she was amused by it, because one of their prior tenets of their life is humility, and to have
right.
You know, somebody making her the star, she was really resistant to that and was very intentional on revealing human sides of her story.
Right. I'm really touched by seeing Sister Martha in the 1980s. She's very feminine. She's very soft-spoken. She's very articulate. She has wonderful things to say.
The first time my father saw me without the full habit on, he said, I've lost my little nun. I had to laugh when I heard him say that, because I never thought he would ever, ever say anything like that.
And then when I see her in the ones that are from like 2019, a lot of that's kind of fallen away, and she just seems much truer. This person is just like bright and shining in front of you. She just says what she thinks.
Oh, the big thing is, how can God let all this bad stuff happen? How come God lets all those people at the border suffer? How come my sister died? That's a God question. So it's got to be, who do you think God is? So yes, that's perennial. It doesn't make any difference what age it is, whether this is the 60s, the 2000s, that doesn't matter. Those are human issues. And so that's what people are talking about.
That comparison to me was kind of breathtaking and beautiful.
Well, you're making my day. I'm glad she came off that way to you. Initially, when we first interviewed in 1987, I was unknown to her, really. And, you know, she was the person put forward by her congregation. You are our spokesperson. Explain to him our way of life. And
yeah.
So much as she was very buttoned down and very put together, I mean, she generally always was, but you didn't get much beyond the gates. And then, as you know, over the next 35 years or so, we became very friendly and trusting and loving in a lot of ways. And so I think the latter interviews, she, as much as a religious sister will do, let her hair down, and, you know, and just, you know, could joke and see the, you know, absurdity of certain things and just, again, be a fully rounded human being as opposed to the scholarly expert there to explain religious life.
First question, always, why did you become a sister? Well, I like to string them along. I say because I couldn't stand my mother and I had to leave the house. They always laugh and then they don't know if I mean it or not. I said, no, no, that's not it. I was in love with this guy and he jilted me and I didn't have anything else to do.
You say on your website that one of the things you want to do with this film is, through the prism of Sister Martha, chart the changes in the religious and cultural landscape of America. And this seems incredibly timely. In 1987, it seemed incredibly timely, right? I mean, we've just seen more and more changes, or same change, but just more extensive, I guess, is what I'm trying to say. When you approached these women in 1987, what was your thought? I mean, you said they're the mean nuns, but when you think about what the women's movement was trying to accomplish, what culture looked like in 1987, did you have any thoughts as you went in? Like, what are these women doing? Why are they doing it?
I was very much under the spell of the Trappist monks that Merton belonged to. And so a commitment to a spiritual life did at that time and still does is very legitimate to me.
Yeah.
Obviously, it's not for everybody, but, you know, for those that do it and do it in the right spirit, it's a beautiful thing. And I'll make this confession, which I've told to the Ursuline sisters. I always thought of the men monks as being sort of more heroically spiritual than the sisters. And then this project has helped me realize the absurdity of that. You know, the monks, they do have this romantic aura of these, you know, spiritual athletes, you know, tucked away in their monastery, whereas these women were right there on the front lines, teaching kids, doing the grunt work, being manipulated and often not used very kindly by the hierarchy. I just think it's worth remembering that we owe these women a lot, as with any group in any institution. Were there bad apples? Yes, of course. But I think the crop was far better than the bad apples.
Earlier you said one of the things that drew you was the sacrifices that they made for your community. So just talk a little bit more about that. We know that she was a teacher. Were most of these women teachers? What were they doing for the community that you saw so valuable?
Yeah, it's interesting. Their congregation came to Louisville in 1858. In 1855, there had been a riot in Louisville where 30 or 40 immigrants were killed by a party called the Know-Nothing Party, which was very nativist. And, you know, any immigrant was bad. And most of these people that were killed in this riot were Catholics, German Catholics. And so the Catholic hierarchy in Louisville said, we need to get some teachers to work with these kids that are, you know, just coming here from Germany and have no one to teach them in their language. So they brought three sisters who had $20 on them, which I'm sure in today's money would be a bit more, but it was still pretty modest. And they started, and just through some help from the hierarchy, but pretty much by their own wits and work, developed this network of schools. And some of the really fine schools in the Louisville area were developed by them.
Women religious have built the church from the bottom up, built its communities, built its hospitals, built its orphanages, built its Catholic school system.
In the 19th century, when the sisters first came here, they had $20. Now, talk about gutsy. They had no idea what they were getting into.
And, you know, they were almost exclusively teachers, and that has evolved and changed over the years. And those three women, you know, they eventually peaked out at over 600 members who were teaching and, you know, devoted to trying to help the community.
Once Vatican II happens, and once some of these ancient ideas about how we interact with people who are not Catholic, the sisters have to sort of dive in and kind of find a new purpose for themselves linked to their founder, but also the change in costume for them, how it became so much more personal in a way. It was less about what the organization was going to tell them what to do, and it became more about them. And then noting that a lot of sisters actually left.
Yeah, right.
All of this was just fascinating to me. Sister Martha decides to stay, but she decides she's not going to teach anymore. As a former teacher, I'm like, I understand.
Right. Yeah. I think she felt like she had paid her dues in that department and was becoming very much recognized as a spiritual director. You know, one of the classic ironies of the Catholic Church is that she was appointed to be the teacher of the men who were deacons.
Right.
And so they bring in this learned woman to teach the deacons, but no, lady, you cannot be a deacon yourself, but you can teach them. And so yeah. You just go, oh, really? Okay. And you know, in their more candid moments, the sisters will go, oh, really? You know, it's not like they are docile sheep by any stretch. Yeah.
Yeah. Back in 2003, I actually lived in Houston, and I was part of a group of people who were protesting the invasion of the U.S. into Iraq. We had this huge protest, and nuns showed up to support us.
Right.
And that was kind of the first time that I'd actually like been face to face with a nun and felt, one, really validated, like, oh, the activist nuns have come. We must be doing something right.
That's right. Right.
But also their warmth and generosity and sort of being visible. They were wearing habits, right?
They wanted. Okay. Yeah.
These women wanted to be visible in that way. So I thought of that as I saw your discussion in the film about what should we wear? How should we wear it? This is a kind of a big change. I don't know that people understand how big of a change this might be for someone. Can you talk a little bit about that change? And I mean, again, it's connected to that religious and cultural landscape in America in a lot of ways.
Yeah, it was a tremendously dramatic change. And some of the sisters within the congregation said, we don't want to change. And so they were allowed to, you know, stay in the full habit. And the others would adapt sort of a modified habit. And some would wear essentially, you know, just normal school clothes. And right. So to me, one of the great ironies or mysteries is that the congregations that tend to be enduring or at least holding their own are the ones that have stayed most rigid and have not really adapted some of the reforms of Vatican II. It's interesting to hear them talk about it. When they loosen things up, a lot of people who had, you know, who are hanging in there, is going to stick with it, said, well, heck, if the rules are changing that much, I'm going to look at other paths.
A number of my very close friends left. Obviously, things were changing in the church and in the world. And as I saw people leaving, I thought, what do I really want to do here? Do I want to stay with this group of women when the future seems so very unsure?
Which was a very traumatic time for the sisters, because these are people, you know, who, again, to use a poor metaphor, you know, I've been in the trenches with, and now they're opting for something else.
But it is interesting to me but once you're allowed to look past teaching and find another way to help the community, that's what I'm really interested in, is that they were like, oh, because they were teachers, they could see there were all kinds of issues that needed to be solved. And then they want to go out and solve them. We heard Sister Martha's story, but were there other stories about what those sisters wanted to go out and work on?
Ursulines, again, in just in their specific congregation, they have a number of sisters who were very involved in speech therapy and in working with the deaf. And some ran an orphanage, which I guess is somewhat very much like education, but they spread out. Some were very involved in social justice issues and environmental issues. And so, yeah, they really broadened. And I would need, I guess, to talk to an organizational expert to say, what is it when the mission of a group sort of becomes more diffuse? You know, do you lose appeal? And so much changed from when Martha joined in the late 40s, where there were so fewer options for women and for women in general. By becoming a sister, you made obvious sacrifices, but there was a path to become a hospital administrator, to become a principal, et cetera, et cetera. Suddenly, there were these other options that people were embracing, and a lot of people found that more attractive.
You have a question on your website. Is the vocation of religious sisters outdated or outmoded? And you're kind of defining that as their self-sacrifice and service. What do you think ultimately after making this movie?
You look at our culture now, and you know it's hard to see any young woman who's not just really exceptionally focused in a spiritual direction wanting to go, yeah, that's for me. There are still vocations, not so much with the Ursulines. They aren't really seeking vocations at this stage. But, you know, there are still people wanting to choose that path. But our culture has really changed so dramatically. It's a tougher sell.
Yeah.
But, yeah, I know in going back to the monks, because their numbers are down dramatically and they're aging. But they say, you know, it's very cyclical. And so often after a world war, in World War II is when Gethsemane grew in leaps and bounds. After major upheavals, people look for a deeper meaning in life. And so often a religious vocation.
You've told us here, but also in the film, you had announced that you asked Sister Martha to be your spiritual director.
Though we were living our lives very differently, we had the same goal. We were looking for meaning. She had found it, along with peace and wisdom. I admired that, so after much hemming and hawing, I asked her to become my spiritual director.
What was it about Sister Martha that you said, this person can help me sort of untangle some of the stuff that I can't untangle on my own?
You know, you can dodge and hide questions which need to be confronted. And so I thought, I'd like to have someone help me do that. And because of my respect for her and her approach, which is not as a, you know, a drill sergeant, well, it's time to do this, this, and this, but as one who helps you see the folly of your ways in a kind way. You know, you go, oh, yeah, well, that's pretty obvious. I can't have that anymore. Well, if nothing else, it kept me searching. I mean, it got me past the delusion that there's one definitive answer and, well, that's it. I mean, there are basic underlying things that you accept as ultimate truths, but the way to embrace them changes as you get older. Each area of your life brings new ways to approach a deeper, richer spiritual commitment. And touching base with her and knowing, oh gosh, in a week I've got to go talk to Martha. I better at least have a good line to give her, if nothing else. But I like the way she described the difference between going to a psychologist or a psychiatrist and going to a spiritual director. The spiritual director is just trying to enhance your relationship with the divine. That's what she endeavored to do, and in many ways for which I'm grateful she did that for me. And making me realize in her own life how it's an ongoing thing. It's not, okay, I'm finished here. sometimes you are finished and you may not even know it, but it's a growing, evolving, everyday thing. And that's that notion of persevering in my time amongst the monks. That was one theme they always came back to, was persevering. And I thought, well, that seems so, that doesn't seem very romantic or exciting. But I mean, that's part of the challenge and the, I hate to say the work, but it is the work of the spiritual life. I mean, you persevere.
We don't know what's going to happen in the future, but we have hope. A future full of hope is what Scripture talks about. So we're women of hope. I mean, we have hung in there together.
I was curious about the gathering of all the footage. Do you have a team that you work with that helps you do like a deep dive on the internet or maybe in the archives of the Ursulines, or how does that work?
Well, yeah, the Ursulines have an archivist, a woman named Laurel Wilson, who was extremely helpful. I mean, you talk about going down rabbit holes. You know, you get into these files, and some of the pictures of those women from back in the 1890s, they're just classic. I mean, you just love it. So they were very helpful. My wife would get a real chuckle out of me saying I'm organized, but when it comes to footage, I do have a pretty good archival system. And then the editor that I work with, Steve Hurst, is very good about, you know, going through the internet and going, you know, I came across this. Does this fit with what you're talking about? And you go, oh yeah.
There's something about a photograph, and I'm not the first person to say this. Many other people have said it. It's like looking at ghosts, you know?
Oh, yeah.
It captures this moment that you don't know until 50 years later, 100 years later, is so important and so precious, and the details of what you're looking at. Sometimes I wish documentaries would really slow. I don't want the Kenneth Burns. I don't need that. But just I need some really, like, give me a little more time with those photos.
I agree. And the style, it's not new. I mean, it's been really emerging as, you know, the quick cut, quick cut, quick cut. And I sort of like to linger and consider.
Yeah, really look at it.
What I would ask your audience to consider is that, you know, if I'm in Utah and come across a podcast or wherever they might see it, and they go, oh, Kentucky Nun, you know, I think I'll try to find something else. I get that. But if you will just think, oh, this is a person's spiritual life, and that is not just about being a nun, it's about being a human being. I'd hope they give that a chance.
Thanks to Morgan Atkinson for speaking with me and sharing his film with me. I was touched by the way Sister Martha grew and evolved over the 35 years the film covered. It gave me hope for me and my own old age, that I too might be a light burning brightly. I've got to start working on wisdom and honesty and thoughtfulness to get there, but she's a true inspiration. VoiceOver is a production of BYU Radio and is edited by Leah Alexander. I'm your host, Heather Bigley.